So our teaching scripture this morning comes from the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John. And I'm going to read the first through fourth verses and verses 14 through 32. It says, "Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent a message to Jesus, 'Lord, he whom you love is ill.' But when Jesus heard it, he said, 'This illness does not lead to death. Rather, it is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" Verse 14, "Then Jesus told them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead. For your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him.' Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go, that we may die with him.' When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, some 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them about their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, while Mary stayed at home. Martha said to Jesus, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him.' Jesus said to her, 'Your brother will rise again.' Martha said to him, 'I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day.' Jesus said to her, 'I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?' She said to him, 'Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world.' When she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary and told her privately, 'The teacher is here and is calling for you.' And when she heard it, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary get up quickly and go out. They followed her because they thought that she was going to the tomb to weep there. When Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, 'Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died.'" This is the word of the Lord.
The late Frederick Buechner, 20th century novelist, preacher, and theologian, whose works have been compared to the likes of C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, conceived of the Christian gospel as tragedy, comedy, and fairy tale. "The gospel is bad news before it is good news," he says. "It is the news that man is a sinner, to use the old word, that he is evil in the imagination of his heart, that when he looks in the mirror all in a lather, what he sees is at least 8 parts, chicken, phony, and slob. And that is a tragedy." While this stark declaration leaves little space for romance and poetry, for the beauty and creativity we know to also be present within humanity, made in the image of God, it also seems true, based on our own lives, our experience of the world, history, the news, the last impatient exchange you shared with your own spouse or child, roommate or friend. Humans are sinful, and that brokenness is killing us all. But the life of this so-called self-serving slob of Buechner's imagination does not begin and end with his destructive behaviors and beliefs. Because the news of the gospel transitions from tragedy and the declaration that this man is loved anyway, cherished, forgiven, bleeding to be sure, but also bled for. And that, says Buechner, is comedy. Zacchaeus climbs up the sycamore tree a crook and climbs down a saint. Paul sets out a hatchet man for the Pharisees and comes back a fool for Christ. The addict, a coach and caregiver. The angry spouse, a patient and repentant partner. hear that this is not the cheap ha-ha comedy, the forgettable direct-to-video kind that Hollywood produces for adolescent markets. It's a Shakespearean comedy wherein deep truth manifests with scandalous irony in the physical world. And then, Buechner says, the gospel is fairy tale. And in this, he doesn't mean not real. He means a glorious ending and a remarkable turnaround, the likes of which truly feel like a fairy tale. Parker didn't read to the end of the story in John 11. The end of this story is that Lazarus is raised from the dead, wrapped in his grave clothes and stinking of death. Lazarus hears Jesus shout his name and tell him to come out. And then a bound, formerly dead man sits up in his grave, walks towards the tomb's opening, up a set of stairs where he meets Jesus, his sister, and the crowd. Without skipping over this miracle, sometimes called Jesus's greatest miracle, I want to turn our attention back in the narrative. See, this story does have the glitz and glamour of a bodily resurrection, exactly the kind of fairy tale-like bow Buechner means to invoke through dramatic metaphor. But the center of this story offers something very real to grapple with. Sometimes there is death, bodily and otherwise, and it does not shimmer with fairy tale glow. It is simply death. And what then? Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, Martha says. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, Mary says. Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Whispered some in the mourning and skeptical crowd. Some in the crowd chattered, reflected on what could have been done, what intervention might have happened if Jesus had come more quickly. He did not come quickly. We are told that Lazarus was ill and then Jesus stayed 2 days longer. But Martha and then Mary turned toward Jesus and said to him directly, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Who talks to Jesus like that? With such boldness and directness. It's not strangers, not his students. Heck, it's the sort of thing that ends up on the internet, but we don't even really see it to people's faces. The only recorded dialogue between Jesus and one of his followers in the whole New Testament with a similar kind of directness is that of Jesus and Peter. I'd like to suggest that Martha and Mary's exclamations to Jesus, exclamations of grief, hurt, sadness, and loss, were expressed precisely because of the closeness of their relationship with Jesus and the relationship that their brother shared with Jesus. Martha, Mary, Lazarus, and Jesus were true friends. And I'd like to take a look at the fullness of this story, especially the beginning and middle part, in light of these relationships. And through that lens, consider exactly what it means when Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. Which is something he says to Martha while her brother still lies dead. In this statement, as in the other I am statements in the book of John, we learn something very important about God and who God is, God's character, and the mission of God revealed to humanity through this revelation. I am the resurrection and the life. And so first, let us turn back in the story and the text to understand the relationships. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This is the same Mary and Martha of Luke's gospel. We're told in that story that Martha welcomed Jesus in her home and her sister Mary sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he was saying. But Martha was distracted by her many tasks. She worked and so became resentful of her sister and who sat and listened to Jesus. And when Martha pointed this out that she was working, he said, Martha, you are worried and distracted by many things, and there is need of only one thing. Mary has chosen the better part, which will not be taken away from her. This short and honestly much abused story posits Mary as a contemplative woman, able to recognize what was most important in that moment was Jesus, not all the work that needed to be done. In contrast, Martha is the hurrier, beating about the home. In art, and I would argue probably in most of our imaginations, Martha is preparing a meal or tending to other domestic work. And indeed, that's possible, though it seems quite important to highlight that the text itself doesn't point towards these, admittedly very important household homemaking tasks. The New Testament scholar Amy Jill Levine highlights the use of the word diakonia in the text. That's the word that describes the service that Martha is doing. And it doesn't have anything to do with meal preparation, at least explicitly. It's the Greek word from which we get the English term deacon, a particular kind of church leadership often associated with acts of charity and care for the most vulnerable in the community. It's a term with pastoral care implications and labor that, in modern contexts, we associate with people in helping professions, people like social workers. In Luke's story, then, it is Mary that sits at Jesus' feet, soaking in what he has to offer, and it is Martha running about, probably because she has her eyes on the people around her that need help. In light of that, Jesus' words to Martha that she is worried and distracted by many things and that there is need of only one thing, which Mary has chosen, takes on a different kind of softness. The Jesuit priest James Martin suggests it's not that Martha's work is wrong. Certainly serving the poor cannot be wrong. God is always on the side of the hurt and disenfranchised. Rather, Jesus' words are a kind of New Testament iteration of Ecclesiastes' most famous line, "To everything there is a season. There is a time for preparing the house and a time for listening." And in Luke, we see Jesus calling Martha to sit with him. This is the history that Martha, Mary, and Jesus share at the beginning of John 11. And therefore, it is no wonder that upon hearing that Jesus was nearly there, Martha went out to meet him. She wanted to be with him, to approach him. Jesus had directly and explicitly affirmed to her personally his desire to be with her. And in the utter brokenness of death and loss, she reached towards the relationship she had already forged with Jesus. Martha, Mary, and their now dead brother Lazarus lived in Bethany, a village about 2 miles from Jerusalem, set atop a limestone ridge in the Mount of Olives. Their home appears to have been a meaningful place of respite for Jesus, where he stepped out of the high of public ministry and relaxed. This appears to be the case not only because of the directness of Martha's and Mary's words, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died," but by the very fact that Jesus came. The lengthy narrative recorded in chapter 11 of John's Gospel states that when Lazarus fell ill, the sisters sent a message to Jesus, stating simply that, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." This is a significant statement, both in its literal words and its implied meaning. When Jesus receives this message, he is not nearby. He is in a relatively safe location east of the Jordan River. He is well into his time of public ministry, and that means his reputation is widespread. Jesus has visited many places where he's healed the sick and broken bread with the outcasts. Jesus has visited the likes of tax collectors and women with whom the public would deem inappropriate company. Crowds in the thousands have come out to see what's going on. His ministry is characterized by miracles, perplexing parables, and peace, even as it upends social norms and social order. At the time in which Jesus received the message from Martha and Mary, Jesus cannot freely move about the country. There are only certain areas in which he is relatively safe. The threat of physical violence from individuals who experience his work as threatening to their position, power, and way of life is high. Earlier this year, I had the distinct pleasure of enjoying a meal at Dookie Chase, and I can honestly say that it was one of the best meals I have ever had in my life. This Black-owned fine dining restaurant in New Orleans began as a sandwich shop in the 1940s, and under the leadership of the late chef Leah Chase and her husband, it became a fine dining establishment. and at one time boasted the largest collection of African-American art in New Orleans. To this day, every wall is covered floor to ceiling with fine art. It's hard not to just be overwhelmed walking from your table to the bathroom, which is also filled with art. Chef Leah Chase became known as the queen of Creole cuisine, and it was truly the best. She also served local and national civil rights leaders as they planned what we now know to be some of the most influential moments of the civil rights movement. Thurgood Marshall, MLK, and other freedom fighters and freedom riders gathered in the restaurant's upper room. King and others who led the Montgomery bus boycott came to Dookie Chase to learn from civil rights leaders in New Orleans and to learn about the bus boycott in Baton Rouge. Indeed, the Montgomery bus boycott was inspired by the boycott in Baton Rouge. It's said that the public officials in New Orleans were aware of these so-called illegal meetings hosted at Dookie Chase, but they did not break them up or shut down the doors of the restaurant, and they didn't out of fear of public backlash. Consider with me the audience that Chef Leah Chase kept at her literal physical table. Consider how they got there and how they got out in the political climate of the 1950s and the 1960s. Chef Chase's restaurant was and remains a veritable cultural, economic, and political powerhouse, and it's not in nearly enough history books. And while everything about that context is entirely different, when I reach into my imagination to understand what it must have been like for Jesus to leave the safe territory that he was in and risk stoning by walking back to his old friends' home, where he had enjoyed great meals and some of his favorite conversations, I can't help but think of the men and women with targets on their backs who came to New Orleans and slipped into Chef Chase's secret dining room. And I can't help but think what it would have been like for Jesus to slip into. And I think Jesus going to Bethany was a little bit like that. In verse 16, Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go with Jesus, that we may die with him." Jesus and the disciples understood the assignment. At this point, geographic movement was a mortal threat. And interestingly, despite Jesus' conversation with the disciples in the first few verses of the chapter, conversation about going to Bethany, they aren't mentioned again once Jesus is actually in Bethany. It seems that they may not have even traveled with him. We don't know how Lazarus, Mary, Martha, and Jesus became friends. Jesus was a builder. Maybe he worked on some projects with Lazarus. Maybe they were all cousins, or maybe there was sort of that familial relationship that's like cousins, even though there's no shared blood. The Bible doesn't give us this information. All we know is that their friendship existed and that it was important. And that when the sisters say, "Lord, the one whom you love is ill," they mean just that. Jesus loved Lazarus. We know Jesus the teacher, Jesus the healer, Jesus the Son of God, and we usually readily affirm Jesus' humanity, but we don't always think of Jesus' humanity in concrete terms. We don't often think about how Jesus longed for friends and built friendships, and what role those relationships played in his life as he walked out the calling and mission that God the Father had given him. And so with that, I invite you to consider with me something about the text that I'd like to argue is a real possibility. In a number of ways, the Gospel of John is distinct from what's known as the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It has a different flow, some of the same stories, but more different stories. It offers extended theological commentary in places where the other Gospels are brief. And one particular and unique bug to John is its reference to, quote, "the one whom Jesus loved," which in some translations is called the beloved disciple. And since that's easier to say, I'm just going to say the beloved disciple. The beloved disciple shows up a few places in John, all of them shortly after the story of Lazarus' death and resurrection. After Jesus was crucified, the beloved disciple brought Jesus' mother into his own home, which means it must have been nearby. The beloved disciple ran faster than Peter to Jesus' tomb, and finding an empty grave, he saw and believed, that Jesus had been resurrected, though Mary was confused and the text doesn't tell us what Peter thinks. And then in the scene near the end of the book of John, the beloved disciples appears to be a witness to Jesus' conversation with Peter, where Jesus asks Peter 3 times if he loves him. At the end of the conversation, Peter asks Jesus about the beloved disciple, simply, "Lord, what about him?" And Jesus answers, "If it is my will that he remain until I come back again, what is that to you?" And this response was enough to fuel a rumor that the beloved disciple would not die. It is a weird conversation, and it is the conclusion to the book of John. I always thought the beloved disciple was John, the son of Zebedee, the fisherman who was called with his brothers to be fishers of men. Another common theory is that the beloved disciple is John Mark, a friend of Peter's in Acts. And I'd like to invite us to consider today that the beloved disciple may have been Lazarus himself. A dear friend of Jesus who hosted Jesus many times, and so of course he took in Jesus' mother at his death. He made it to the tomb first because he was fast, but also because he knew the land. It was near his home. And when Jesus was gone and he saw the graves closed, specifically the head covering, the same kind of head covering that would have been put on his own head just a few days prior, it makes sense that he would believe and understood that Christ was resurrected. It was his own experience. And finally, that final exchange between Peter and Jesus at the end of the book, when Peter asks about the beloved disciple and Jesus coming back, the rumor that disciple would never die. It is a weird conversation and a weird rumor, but it does make sense if the disciple himself had just been raised and if that's the person that they were talking about. And finally, the words of Lazarus's sister, the ones right here in the chapter today, "Lord, the one whom you love is ill." The one whom you love. The sisters are literally identifying Lazarus as beloved. Now, there are things in scriptures that until God reveals one way or another, we can never really know exactly. But consider this. If the beloved disciple is Lazarus, it expands our imagination of the friendship that Jesus and Lazarus shared together and the pain that Mary, Martha, and Jesus shared together at Lazarus' death. And if the beloved disciple is someone else, that's okay. There's still ample evidence that Jesus, Lazarus, and the sisters were all friends, and that's the real point here. This exercise in examining the possibility helps us appreciate the depth and beauty of the interpersonal relationships that Jesus had with those that he loved. And that relationship is critical to understanding the dialogue between Martha and Jesus when she runs out to meet him. When Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out and met him while Mary stayed home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that God will give you whatever you ask of him." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into this world." Martha greets Jesus with anger. And in meeting Jesus with anger, she also meets him with honesty. Jesus could have saved her brother, and as she states, even now, the Father will give Jesus whatever he asks. There's a common explanation for Jesus' delay. Remember, he waited 2 days after hearing the news that Lazarus was ill to begin his journey. And by the time that he arrives, Lazarus has been dead 4 days. It's plausible that some of the ancient Jews present in Bethany at the time believed that the soul hovered around the body for about 3 days. Thus, in order for Jesus' resurrection of Lazarus to be a real full resurrection of a fully dead man, Lazarus would have needed to have been dead more than 3 days. Another explanation. James Martin points towards the 5th century bishop St. Peter Christologus, who argued that for Jesus, it was more important to conquer death than to cure disease. And thus, instead of a remedy for Lazarus's illness, Jesus offered him the glory of rising from the dead. Or perhaps more simply, Jesus waited because he was waiting for the go-ahead from his Father. Jesus waited in prayer until it was time. There's something deeply off-putting about this possibility because it still involves waiting, but there is also something familiar in it. We wait in prayer too. We wait and listen. Earlier in John, Jesus states, "Very truly I tell you, the Son can do nothing on his own, but only what he sees his Father doing." Maybe Jesus was waiting on the Father. Now, each of these explanations offers some kind of logic, reaching to resolve our discomfort at Jesus' late arrival, because it seems to contradict love, care, and relationship that we know that Jesus shared with this family. I think that each of these explanations has something compelling within it, something that makes sense, and none of them fully resolve my own discomfort with Jesus' tardiness. That experience of multiple emotions in one, multiple pieces of logics and belief intertwined, is a deeply human one, and I think we see something similar in Martha's conversation. Anger, grief, hope for resurrection, and yet when resurrection first comes into the picture, Martha is not thinking right now. When Jesus says, "Your brother will rise again," Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." She is angry with Jesus, and she still trusts him. She repeats her belief in the resurrection in the end times, a commonly held grounding belief in her community. And to that, Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord, I believe you are the Messiah, the Son of God." The whole dialogue bounces between past, present, and future references. Lazarus died because Jesus wasn't there to save him. That's in the past. Martha says, "But even now, in the present, God will do whatever Jesus asks of him." And when Jesus invokes Lazarus's future resurrection, Martha makes a statement about the long future ahead, and Jesus comes right back to the present. Jesus isn't talking about the last day. "I am the resurrection and the life" is a statement for right now that Jesus declares in the present tense, though Lazarus still lies dead in the tomb. And struck by the use of the word "believe" in this exchange, "those who believe in me, even though they die, will live, and everyone who lives and believes will never die," my brain ties the word "believe" to the word "faith," which on first reflection I'd define as confidence in something for the future, in some sort of resolve. It's casting my eyes out ahead and calling what I hope for and choose to believe will happen. I shared this definition with someone recently who came back and asked if I was sure. That confidence for something in the future, what is it based on? Think of what a loving parent might say to an adolescent or a young adult that they are not confident that they will live to see fully grow into themselves in adulthood. What would that parent say? I imagine that they would name their child's strength, character, and loves, and with confidence for the future, express their belief in their child's ability to grow and flourish and become exactly who God bade them to be in this world. That kind of statement is both belief and faith. In that scenario, the parent absolutely holds and affirms with confidence this thing for the future that they do not expect to live to see. But their confidence isn't based on the inherent goodness present in their child's creativity or intelligence that they know will reach into the world somewhere and bring healing. It's in their child, whom they have always known and loved. In other words, faith and belief are not based on the substance of what it is that you are looking out for, however good it may be. It's based on your relationship with the person or entity that will bring forth that future thing. Jesus declares that he is the resurrection and the life in the present, though for Jesus and Martha, the present experience is also death. By declaring life in the place of death, by declaring resurrection while Lazarus's body still rots in the tomb, it's like Jesus is declaring truth and more truth. There is mortal death now and also life and resurrection now. Jesus is there now, and the life Jesus offers is eternal life, It is for now and also for the future, and Martha clings to this. She believes it to be true because of who Jesus is. Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into this world. Her faith, her belief is based on her relationship with the one speaking, Jesus himself, her friend, the Son of God. And because of that, she holds to the truth of Christ's word, his declaration that he is the resurrection and the life, now and in the future. And she states this belief in the same conversation that she started with the declaration, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. The theological framework that describes this tension is often referred to as the already and the not yet. Jesus is the resurrection and the life. He says this before he even died and rose again. This is who he is. Jesus brings forth peace and wholeness. He's on the side of the oppressed, and in him we see what God has done since the beginning, lean towards communion with creation of which we are part. This is the comedy of Buechner's framework. Despite all the things, God embraces humanity, and in this, God sets right what is broken. Broken hearts and broken bones, broken families and broken dreams. This setting right is the stepping into the already. Jesus is already the resurrection and the life, and we are invited to take part in that. And so, in labor and in love and in works of service, filled with the Spirit, as Mary and Martha were invited to be filled at Jesus' feet, we partner with what God's Spirit is already doing. And in so doing, we declare that death is not the end and that we contend for life now, even as we wait, even though it is not all done. In his explanation of gospel as fairy tale, Buechner describes fairy tale as, quote, a world of magic and mystery, of deep, dark, and flickering starlight. Quoting Tolkien, the maker of Hobbits and Middle Earth, he explains that fairy tale does not deny the existence of sorrow and failure. The possibilities of these is necessary to the joy of the deliverance. It denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal final defeat, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy. Joy beyond the walls of this world, poignant as grief. And so we glimpse joy in the destruction of the ring at Mordor, understand its significance, and still, as Buechner describes, the universal triumph of good is still only a hobbit's dream. And the golden age of elves and dwarves is fated to be followed by the tragic age of men. Yet the tears that come to our eyes at the joy of the fairy tale are nevertheless essentially joyous tears, because what we have caught a glimpse of, however fleeting, is joy itself. The triumph, if not of goodness, at least of hope. This is the already and the not yet. This is Jesus, the resurrection and the life, at the moment in which Lazarus remains dead in the grave. In holding this framework, there's a natural temptation to bend in one direction or another. One can hold the already and the not yet in the abstract, to believe in the life and resurrection fairy tale joy that Tolkien describes, but mostly to believe in theory, or to believe that life and resurrection and joy can come only in plain clothes. I once lectured a small group of graduate students in a theology class, and a principal part of the lecture was the already and the not yet. And I knew these students. I expected this idea to be new to many of them, and they boldly asserted their abundant familiarity with it, which is great. Except the reason I thought that it would be a new idea to many of them was because they didn't pray for healing. They didn't seem to expect even the occasional direct cause and effect in their prayers, which does not mean that they did not fervently and faithfully pray to God, but it was abstract. It was like they didn't realize how much could happen in their prayers. And on the other hand, the possibility and the already and the not yet, that's too much already. This is a word of faith that cannot confront, cannot face, cannot name the death that stands right in front of them. Because the truth of God is working, but just as Lazarus was dead, there are children and war. And there are people all across our city who just learned of their diagnoses and what the insurance won't cover. There are terminated positions and childhood traumas and lack of material resources and lack of love. I believe that Jesus is the resurrection and the life, and that that speaks to and is for each of these situations, and it's not all the way there yet. To state otherwise is dishonest, and it's not what Jesus did when he put himself in mortal danger to come to Bethany and weep with his friends. If you've been around Central or other Vineyard spaces for a while, this framework of the already and not yet may be familiar to you. It's a foundation to why we pray the way that we do, but even in that, there's a risk of malformation. A little while back, I was reading all four of the Gospels straight through like they were one long book. And to be clear, I did this over the course of multiple days, not in one go, but I was reading it like they were singularly bound, you know, Penguin paperback. And when you do that, it's easy to hear the similarities from gospel to gospel and the places where certain details stick out like a sore thumb. And the thing that stood out to me most was that of all the things, that would shine like stars in Buechner's fairy tales, I was drawn to the miracles, all of them. All those people that Jesus healed. And I knew as I was reading that I was reading the stories of the people that Jesus healed, not the stories of the people in the crowd that didn't get to spend one-on-one time with him, not the stories of the people who needed physical healing and didn't get it. Furthermore, I know that there's also a lot of violence in the New Testament, not all of which is detailed in the Gospels, that Jesus was killed and many of his disciples also died violent deaths. Certainly, the kingdom of God is not all sunshine and roses. And still, in sitting with all the Gospels side by side, I felt an invitation from the Lord to soften and reshape my own conception of the already and not yet. Yes, I did, and I do believe in the already part, which shines like the joys of Buechner's fairy tales. And I think that sometimes I treat that joy, the miracle that it is, like fireworks on a holiday. It is something that we are sometimes lucky enough to see. But my frame of own mind was almost like that was something extra, something that we sometimes get as a gift. And by that, I mean I had all the explanations ready for why the not yet is still present too. And I wondered if my theology of the kingdom of God, my theology of the already and not yet, was perhaps wider than the Gospels themselves. Because Jesus is the resurrection and the life, and the belief for that future thing is about relationship with Jesus. And that's something for right now, even before Lazarus is raised. Maybe you're like me, and maybe you grip onto the already and struggle to identify with the present not yet. I think what we hold on to is very connected to our own experiences and the experiences of the ones that we love. Except in that, I pray that through it all, every stage of it, we would know Jesus as the resurrection and the life at every stage that moves in between. We're going to take just a minute to sort of sit. Parker, if you want to come up here and join me. In a few minutes, the kids will be coming in the back. But I just want to sit in quiet.